Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of April 18th. This week we were joined by Professor Kenneth Himes of Boston College to talk about his article, Divided on Torture, which appears in this week's issue. I began by asking Professor Himes about the Obama administration's policy on torture and how it differs from the George W. Bush administration.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the president has been, you know, rather clear in his disavowal of torture, and he on several occasions has made reference to what he saw as former policies that he considered unacceptable. And the executive order that he issued the day after he was inaugurated certainly indicates his reservations about some of what had been done in the recent past. At the same time, as everyone knows, we haven't been able to close Guantanamo. That's not to say that human rights violations continue there or that torture continues there, but it's just to say that among the promises that the president has made about the treatment of detainees, he hasn't been able to fulfill all of them. Some of that are for legal reasons, some of it's national security reasons, some of it I suspect is purely practical and reasons. But I think it's fair to say that there is still some risk that that we are at least complicit in acts of torture or abuse of detainees in terms of our rendition of certain people to other countries that continue to torture or continue to abuse people they hold captive. And I do think that there remain some concerns about the oversight of our own forces in the field and some of our coalition partners in terms of how they treat detainees. That may not be a matter of official policy, but nonetheless, I think there is still a risk out there that we have some role or at least some extended complicity in the mistreatment of those people who are detained by our forces.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction you draw in your article between, on the one hand, you know, repudiating torture as a matter of law, but on the other hand, as a matter of practice, in terms of enforcement and, you know, the various U.S. agencies, there seems to be a distinction there that, that is problematic.
I think it is, Tim. I think it is problematic, and I think it is a distinction. Now, some of that is always, you know, some of that is simply the space between our best stated intentions and what actually we are able to do. And I wouldn't want to ascribe always bad intentions on the part of the president or others in the administration, policymakers, when you find some of those gaps. I mean, you can have the best policies in the world, but as we know, war is a tough business, and people make decisions sometimes let's say, not the calmest or most sensible way, right. But they're working out of fear, they're working out of anxiety, they're working out of anger, and sometimes people do things that policies and laws can't prevent them from. That said, I do think that one of the concerns I have, and one of the reasons why I wrote the article, is that it seems to me the American public, for the most part, we have simply ignored the evidence that we have tortured in the recent past, and we've sort of now, I think since President Obama has taken office, we just presume that everything has gone along fairly hunky-dory since then. And I think we have to really ask ourselves as a people, as a nation, what have we done in the past? What have we allowed to have been done in our name? And is there the appropriate, you might say, scrutiny by citizens of policies of our nation?
Right. You write in your article that, you know, as is known, when Obama took office, his administration did not seem interested in kind of holding previous administration officials accountable for kind of any complicity in torture. But you lay out a couple of other options that may be considered. Maybe you can go through those.
That's correct. I mean, it was very clear that the president did not want to get involved in what I suspect many people saw would turn into a kind of political firefight if we started to go after former administration officials or former policymakers for decisions that they had made. That doesn't rule out that those people may find themselves in situations down the road, the International Criminal Court or other sorts of activities by other states. But I think at least in this country, there seems to be little appetite to pursue criminal charges against former administration officials in the George W. Bush administration. But in addition to that, to say that we don't want to go that route, and I'm not necessarily advocating that we should, but to say we disavow that route, possibly for good reasons, it doesn't mean we have to do nothing. Although doing nothing is, in fact, one of the arguments that some people make. Some people argue that the simple fact of the matter is, on these kinds of matters, let history be the judge, and that down the road, 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years out, when perhaps some of the strong partisanship over the Iraq War has ended, when some of the some of the anger and some of the bitterness over the war has ebbed, people may look at this with a cooler head and say, oh my goodness, we did some things here that were terrible. And that's the view of some, that just let history do that, and that's punishment enough for those whose reputations will be viewed in the calm of historical judgment. A second option that some people have called for is for Congress to have an investigation that would be bipartisan. And I think the reaction of a lot of people to that is, in the present climate in our country, hard to imagine Congress can pull that off, that the climate seems to be so divided and so partisan that this would simply become one more issue that would be deeply divisive within the present legislature of the country. Another option, and the one that I actually sort of favor myself, is the option of having a panel of people made up of individuals who are not seen as highly partisan, perhaps retired federal judges or lifelong diplomats who have served multiple administrations, or retired military officers, perhaps respected educational leaders or religious leaders from around the country who are not seen to be overtly partisan. And to empower that kind of group with the ability to subpoena and to also grant immunity if they hold hearings, to grant immunity to witnesses, either partial or total, so that they can get at the facts. And it seems to me the crucial thing here would be to find out and make clear and have on record, what did we actually do? Because there is still some debate and there is still some lack of clarity as to what exactly we did do, who authorized it, under what conditions. And then, it seems to me, an important part of this panel's work would be not just to kind of get at the facts from the past, but really to educate us today, citizens today, and to promote or prompt a fairly lively, one would hope, but at the same time civil and thoughtful debate in this country about where do we as Americans stand on what is the proper way for us to treat detainees in the age of terror.
Yes, the question of public opinion, it seems key to your article, and we mentioned Guantanamo Bay and the decision, not to close it that the president made recently, or at least saying that in the short term that doesn't seem possible, it largely seems to be a result of that there is public opinion is they don't want to move these suspects, for example, to, prisons in the United States. So it's a real obstacle both on the question of torture and also, how to deal with these suspects.
I think that's right, Tim. And I guess what I would say is I'd like to see us make a distinction between public opinion and public philosophy. And that is, public opinion, as we all know, can move with the headlines of the day. What people say on Monday could change dramatically tomorrow, if something happens in the news and all of a sudden people are talking differently. But then I'd like to see if we could locate the public philosophy of our nation. And what I mean by that is, what are those perhaps deeper values, deeper concerns, deeper ideals that we cherish as a people that don't change quite so much as the vagaries of public opinion? And if we could locate this debate on torture in that sort of context, to ask ourselves, what are the things that we cherish, what are the values that we hold, what are the ideals we want to stand for, and if we can situate the debate in that context, I would be hopeful, at least, that we could come to a point where it's a bit more thoughtful, a bit more deliberative, and I hope we would come up with a policy that is more humane and more respectful of the rights, even of those people who have done horrible and terrible things.
And you mentioned in terms of public opinion that American Catholics aren't too different in terms of their attitudes towards torture versus other Americans.
That's correct. In fact, there's some evidence that Catholics, in fact, maybe especially regular church-attending Catholics, may actually be more tolerant of torture under certain circumstances than others. And I don't know how to fully understand that, but it is a mystery to me how we can venerate the Lord that we do, who himself was a victim of torture, and how we can regularly pray and worship in his name, and yet at the same time be so readily accepting of torture under certain circumstances. So it's a real case for me of where it seems to me at times our religious sensibilities don't make the or don't lead to the sort of moral transformation that one would hope.
And I should note that the bishops have written on this, and they have a study guide you mentioned here, Torture is a Moral Issue.
That's correct.
So there is a resource from the church's leadership here in this country.
That's right, and it's readily found online through the Bishops' Conference, can be downloaded as a PDF file and available to people to use in discussion groups for themselves or personal study or with others. And the bishops are quite clear on this, as is the Compendium on Catholic Social Teaching. Catholicism's formal position on this is quite clear and quite absolute in terms of the ban on torture under any circumstance. But this is a case where, the people in the pews and the church's leadership are not exactly in the same place. We see that in a number of areas. Sometimes, liberals cheer that, and sometimes conservatives bemoan it. Here we have a situation where I suspect a good many liberal Catholics would bemoan the fact that the people in the pews aren't always in sync with the church's leadership on this question of torture.
Well, you provide a helpful sidebar in your piece, looking back at history. And for those who think or worried that public opinion may never change, you look back to the 18th century when, at the beginning of the century, every European country allowed torture in its criminal law code. By the end of the century, no country did. Maybe you can just outline what happened there.
Yeah, well, really what happened in many ways is a confluence of several events. But I think the individual that I acknowledge, I think, as being particularly important is Cesare Beccaria, an Italian jurist and philosopher and public intellectual. And Beccaria actually wrote a book that was looking at the criminal justice system as he saw it and experienced it in Europe, and raised questions about whether or not the methods of punishment, not just torture, but various approaches to punishment, including the death penalty, how that squared with our sense of justice. That the book that he wrote and the conversation, you might say, that he helped to kick off or to start off really became a transformative event, so that over the course of a number of decades and with the input of various religious leaders, secular philosophers, political leaders, humanitarian groups, we really began to see a movement within the European nations that our criminal justice system was, you might say, abusive and not terribly respectful of the basic dignity of those judged to be guilty, or even those who were being detained awaiting trial. And what we saw was, over the course of that century, a dramatic transformation in terms of one nation after another disavowing the idea of the use of torture, either to obtain information in the criminal justice proceedings or to use torture as a form of punishment against those who were judged to be guilty in criminal justice trials.
Finally, you mentioned that Beccaria also wrote against the death penalty or looked at it. Is there a parallel in our time, you know, in the fact that some states are now starting to abolish the death penalty and maybe public opinion is changing? Is there anything to learn from that example?
You know, I think as a committed Catholic theologian myself, Tim, I am convinced that grace has the final word, not sin. And I do believe that most people, when presented with the experience and the realities of, evil in our world, that when confronted by that, when they confront it in a thoughtful, a prayerful, a dialogical way with others, that it's possible for people to condemn the evils that we find in our world without necessarily losing all sense of perspective of the human dignity that remains, even for those people who are guilty of criminal activities. And my hope is that this is one of the areas where we will slowly begin, or we are slowly beginning to catch up, and to recognize that no one today seriously believes we should use torture to punish people, it seems to me, as a result of a criminal trial. We've gotten beyond that. No one believes in torturing people for the sake of showing one's domination or control of others. But in this age of torture, or age of terror, rather, I think the one remaining appeal that torture has to some people is they have a suspicion or a belief that, well, sometimes some acts of torture get information that is vital to save lives. And people, you might say, almost are willing to condone torture for, in their own minds, a kind of humanitarian impulse. And I think that's, again, one of those areas that we need to talk about as a nation. Is that hope that people have that torture actually saves lives, is that true? And that's part of the needed conversation we have, need to have. And even if it is, or even if there is some social utility to torture, is that enough of a moral justification to do it? Those are the kinds of questions that I think serious people can rightly discuss and debate. And I would hope we could have those kinds of conversations in the coming months or years so that eventually we come to a clear denial of both the utility and the morality of torture.
Well, Professor Kenneth Hines, we want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. The article is in the April 18th issue. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tim. Nice to speak with you.
Well, thank you again for joining us for the America Magazine podcast, and I encourage you to look online this week where we have a review of the film Soul Surfer from John McCarthy, and we also have a short interview with the actor Dennis Quaid, who appeared in that film. Also online this week, we have an article examining the U.S. and international community's intervention in Libya from Mary Ellen O'Connell. A reminder, you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.